And competing for these 22 theaters are a minimum of 200 attractions that want to come in. The chances are against his finding a theater. But let's say that he finds a theater. Now he calls you in, you, the author. We're going to suppose that you have written the libretto of a musical comedy. This is the most complicated kind of theater, and I think we'll give you the best picture. He calls you in, and he says, now look, I've been reading your script, and it needs a lot of work. Let's get it done now before we start auditioning and rehearsing. Now, I think that the character of John should be built up. He's a Ray Bolger type, but the part is too small, you see, to interest Bolger. So you build up John, let him get the girl in the end. And you say, well, what about Stephen? Well, says the producer, he seems a little nothing. Why don't you have him killed at the end of the first act? And you say, but he appears all through the second act. And the producer says, exactly what I mean. You've got a lot of work to do. Now, you go back to your room and get to work. I'm very busy at the dress factory, and I'll see you tomorrow. So the next day, you come in with your play rewritten, and he looks at it, and he says, no, not quite right. Try it again. Very friendly at this point. So you go back and try it again. You bring it in the next day. The next day, he's hired a director. The director reads your new version of the script, and he says, no, it's not right. You shouldn't kill Stephen at the end of the first act. The producer says, well, I thought we could get Ray Bolger if we build up the part of John. The director says, no, Bolger's going to make a picture, so we can't get him. Well, says the producer, in that case, in that case, the producer says to you, rewrite it back to its original form, but keep that new scene in the chicken house. That's a beauty. So you rewrite and bring it in again. Now this time the director is seized with a great inspiration. He leaps up and he says, I got it. Why not make the character of John a woman? Because then Beatrice Lilly might be interested. It's a perfect Lilly type. Now this, of course, means that you have to make the character of the leading woman a man, but you can do it, says the producer. Go home and rewrite. So you go home and rewrite. Meanwhile, a composer and a lyricist have been hired. The composer decides he wants songs, where you haven't left any room for songs. You rewrite. The lyricist looks over the script and helps himself to your choicest lines for the lyrics. There's nothing you can do except write new lines. Now the director gets some more ideas, and so does the producer. The director's ideas don't coincide with the producer's. The producer fires the director. A new director is hired. He has some ideas for changes. You rewrite. A choreographer is hired. He swishes in and decides to turn your first act finale into a ballet. You rewrite. The choreographer also decides that he wants the tempo changed in one of the songs. The composer refuses to change the tempo. The choreographer says he will go home and take poison. The director restores peace by having you rewrite so the song comes in another place. You rewrite. Now a set designer is called in. He looks things over and tells you that the set changes are not possible in the time you have allotted for them. You rewrite. A costumer is called in. He sketches costumes. The choreographer does not like the costumes for the ballerinas in the first act finale. He says they look like evening gowns and the ballet takes place in the morning. They do not look like evening gowns, says the costumer. They do so, says the choreographer. They do not, says the costumer. They scratch each other. The The director says you will rewrite so that the ballet takes place in the evening. You rewrite. Now the auditions begin. A Broadway audition is the 20th century equivalent of a slave market. You have never seen anything quite so brutal in your life. In a musical, there are normally about 50 parts to be cast. And for those 50 parts, there are anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 applicants. And they are herded into the wings by a couple of loud-voiced stage managers, pushed out on stage one after another. They're allowed to sing 8 bars or dance 8 bars, depending on how you're auditioning them. And that's all, off. And you, the director, the composer, the production team, sits out in front and watches these poor souls being herded across the stage. The auditions begin. The first woman to come out is 75 years old. But she has a tremendous voice. The composer says, "My God, high C above middle E, I got to have that dame." And you look at him and say, "But this is a college musical." You rewrite. Sometimes you're lucky. Sometimes you get an actor who looks the part and sings the part and dances the part as you have written it. But it doesn't happen often. Actors have their own peculiarities, their own bits of business, and almost always you have to rewrite a part to suit the style of an actor, and you rewrite. Now comes the rehearsals after the cast has been hired. The first day of rehearsals, the soubrette walks over to you and says, "Hey, come here. This line is too long," she says, showing you a line in the script. And you say, "All right, I will shorten it." She runs over to the director and says, "This beast is cutting my line." So you'll have to give her a new line for the one you shorten. During the next 4 weeks, the following things happen. The prima donna refuses to sing unless the key is transposed in all her ballads. 2 ballerinas fall into the orchestra pit during an arabesque. The baritone threatens to quit unless more padding is put into his shoulders. The lead comic embellishes his part with various bits he has picked up in burlesque. 3 blue-jowled strangers who have money in the show come up with suggestions involving 3 blondes in the chorus. The director throws the 3 blue-jowled strangers out of the theater. They go to the producer. The producer fires the director and takes over the direction himself. The cast quits in a body. The director is rehired. The juvenile lead gets picked up in Jersey City on a Man-Act charge. Now here is your schedule, you the writer, during these 4 weeks of rehearsal. You get there, you get the theater at 11 o'clock in the morning. You are there until midnight watching rehearsals. At midnight, a conference is called of the production team, composer, choreographer, etc. They all have suggestions involving new rewriting. Then you get back to your room about 3 or 4 in the morning, and you have to get that rewriting done before the next day's rehearsals. During rehearsals, with luck and Nembutal, you average about 3 hours sleep. But finally, rehearsals are over, and you start your road tryout, normally in New Haven. Now, during rehearsals, you've been working on a bare stage, without costumes, without sets, without an orchestra. All you've had is a piano and 1 light, and the cast wearing their own clothes. Now, in New Haven, for the first time, you get your costumes, you get your sets, and you get your orchestra. Now, the orchestra has never seen the score. You've got 24 hours to teach the stagehands how to handle the mechanical end of the play, to teach the orchestra the score, to give the cast a dress rehearsal in the set. It's a sleepless 24 hours. And then it's opening night in New Haven. You're out front. There's a cold lump where your stomach ought to be. The overture begins. The brasses are two beats behind. The overture ends. The curtain rises. 12 stagehands are discovered on stage. The curtain goes down. The curtain goes up again. The performance begins. Lines are blown. Cues are missed. Lights fail. Lyrics are forgotten. Costumes split open. It's got open. Now, compared to the little arguments you've been having in New York, what happens in New Haven is cataclysmic. Everybody flies at everybody else's throat. But by this time, you, the writer, have learned to stand up for your rights, and so you fight back. It's a horrible split week in New Haven. For 3 days and three nights, you fight. But somehow, that show gets cut and trimmed, and when you open in Boston, it looks almost good. You run 2 weeks in Boston normally. During the first week, you make more changes, tinker some more, fix here and fix there. But at the end of the first week, the director, if he's got any sense, says, okay, this is it. This is the show we open with in New York. I want the cast to play it for a week in Boston before we get to New York. No more changes. And at first you think you're relieved. You say, thank God. You go back to your hotel room, you take off your shoes, you sit down. No more changes. And then all of a sudden lines start coming to you. Great lines, wonderful, funny jokes. But it's too late. The director won't let you put him in, and he's quite right. There's a limit to the amount of things you can throw at actors and expect them to stand up. And now you're in New York. I don't think it's possible to communicate to you the excitement that accompanies opening night in New York. This is zero hour. This is the culmination of all the sweat and blood and tears and work that you've poured into your play. If it goes, you're golden boy. You're the toast of the town. If it flops, you're a bum. And you go backstage, and all the arguments, all the rivalries, all the hatreds are forgotten. You go backstage and congratulate everybody and wish them well. And you mean it. You mean it from the bottom of your heart. And they wish you the same, and they mean it. And then you go out front and sit down in the glittering first night audience. Now make no mistake about the first night audience. They are not there to wish you well. They want to dance on your grave. They can hardly wait to get over to Sardi's to tell everybody, my dear, it's awful. But they're influential. And then there are the nine assassins, the critics. And nothing can be done about them. You sit there feeling disembodied, as though it really isn't happening. The overture begins, the curtain goes up, and the performance is fine. Opening night performances almost invariably are excellent, because these people, these actors, are troopers, and they know the chips are down, and they are putting forth their very best, and they do a good job. And then the performance is over, and all the first-nighters run backstage to tell everybody how wonderful it was. But you don't pay any attention, because they do that even with the biggest turkeys. And then you go to the producer's party, and you keep drinking whiskey. But there's a clamminess inside of you that chills the warmth of the liquor. You don't feel a thing. And about 2 o'clock, somebody comes in with a morning notice, and you're dead. You're through, because the critics have murdered you. Well, what do you want to write for the theater for? I've painted a pretty black picture of the writing business here this afternoon. Maybe a little too black. Certainly there are editors on magazines and in publishing houses who are intelligent, who look for new young writers, who try to foster talent wherever they can, but they are in the minority. And there are a few producers who look for new things, but they are also in the minority. It's a tough business. I will not withdraw from that statement. It's a tough business, and I recommend it to nobody. And now, in conclusion, I will tell another anecdote. because I believe that it is important not only to open with an anecdote, but to close with an anecdote, so that the audience does not remember what happened in between. In this story, which took place several years ago, it was the opening night of a Gertrude Lawrence play. And Noel Coward thought of a very funny and witty telegram to send to Gertrude Lawrence on her opening night. And he went into the Western Union office and composed the telegram and signed it Mayor LaGuardia. The Western Union girl looked at it and said, "I am sorry, we are not allowed to accept telegrams with fictitious names." And he said, "Well, it's just a big rib. It's a very funny joke, terribly amusing." And she said, "No, no, can't be done." So he said, "Oh, very well," and scratched out Mayor LaGuardia's name and wrote Noel Coward. She looked at him and she said, "Look, I just told you, you're not allowed to sign fictitious names." And he said, "But I am Noel Coward," and produced his billfold and proved it. She thought for a minute and said, "Well, in that case, you can sign Mayor LaGuardia's name." Now, I'd like to throw the thing open to questions for about 15 minutes if anybody has any questions to ask.